This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, as always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, PARDES.org.IL, for helping make this class happen. Okay, so we left off at a very important point in the Christian story. Just to give you guys the big picture of what we're going to do today, I'm going to come back to that story, and I want to sort of lock into place our understanding. Remember, I told you that the sort of subtitle of last week's class is setting the stage for the Middle Age, right? That a lot of what we're doing right now is trying to get the pieces in place to understand the development of what most people know as Judaism, which really reaches its development between the years of, let's say, 700 and 1,000. And then has a good 800 years of glory days, maybe, depending on how you look at it, depending on how you feel about the Cossacks, right? Has about 800 years of continuity until the sort of blows of modernity begin in the late 18th, early 19th century. So we're going to start off with not finishing up, but locking in the understanding of Christian thought and how it relates to what we today call anti-Semitism, right? Then I also want to look back geographically to the land of Israel and talk about how did it go from being the homeland to the Holy Land, right? And everything that implies for Jewish continuity and the conception of landed embodied life. And last but certainly not least, depending on if we get there, we have to touch the rise of Islam, because that's the next major element of world culture that lies on our sort of historical arc. So that's small task, and it's what we're going to do today. So let's get going. So we left off our conversation about Christianity looking at the church fathers. Remember, there's this time period called patristic Christianity, right? Which, depending on which scholar you ask, basically lasts up until around, they range from the 5th to the 9th century. I'm going to go with the 6th century, just to be difficult. So in particular, we were speaking about the personality of Augustine. But just to pull back a little bit, remember, what's the fundamental problem that Christianity faces in relationship to the Jews? We're still there, right? We saw Justin Martyr's replacement theology. We saw, which from a theological standpoint says the Jews have been replaced. We saw John Chrysostom's what we would call more pastoral opposition, which is that you can't have people going to shul on Saturday and taking communion on Sunday, right? It's bad for business. There's a lot of confusion about whether you're a Jew or a Christian, since the idea of a Jewish Christian is alive and well even in the 4th century. So those are two elements in the background. And we didn't speak about it because the question came up several times. Where does the vicious hatred come from? Let's not forget that the hatred of the Jews in Greco-Roman culture well predates the church. The hatred of the Jews in Greco-Roman culture, we could trace it back to, I have a great quote in the old source book from Hecatus of and it's like the 4th century before the Common Era, already bashing the Jews as a slave religion and Moses is a loser and all this great stuff. So there's a long backstory to the cultural opposition to Judaism. And furthermore, we have in this class touched on the three Roman Jewish wars. Mm-hmm. Right? And I told you guys, what came out of that? What impression did the Jews give to Rome? Were what? The indigestible element. More than trouble. The indigestible element of empire. Rome's aspiration, like Hellenism before it, was to have one world. Now, the Romans weren't the same sort of cultural juggernaut that Greece was. I mean, in many ways, they picked up. That's why we call it Greco-Roman culture. Nevertheless, Rome was interested in hegemony. We don't care if the Jews want to have their religion and do their thing, but they got to pay their taxes and allow us to make the rules. Right? And the Jews, for many reasons that we've touched on, weren't going to play that game. So we had 1, 2, 3 Roman wars, and it left the Romans. Remember, we saw that piece by Cassius Dio, the second century Roman historian, when he described the Quitos War, War number 2, right? And we spoke about how he accused the Jews of sawing their enemies in half and skinning them and using their skins as clothes and boiling their enemies alive and, yeah, like really brutal stuff, and how the Jews so depopulated North Africa that no Jew is allowed to set foot in North Africa or Cyprus to this day, he says. And we have this question, since he's the only record of those events, is this true? Well, this is what we know that in general, right, what we think of objectivity in history, right, was not it wasn't even just not the strong suit of late antiquity. It wasn't their goal. Because I think they fully understood the power of the poet. You know why people exaggerate when they tell a story? They want to make a point and an impression. And they want to make, and particularly the historian wants to make a point and an impression that's going to last for generations. So even though, I mean, I'll use a rough example, but I think it's a good one. 11 Jews were murdered in a synagogue in Pittsburgh only a few weeks ago. It's a horrible thing, especially for those of us, anyone that has personal attachments there. I happen to grow up actually going to that show on a regular basis, my USY also. You're a Pittsburgher. So it's horrible. No, but what if you want the people of Pittsburgh to remember this in 300 years? Will the death of 11 innocent people matter as much in 300 years as it does right now? One hopes. At the same time, knowing the world as I do, it might get lost in the static. And so therefore, there's a dangerous desire to exaggerate in order not just to make the point, which is its separate issue, but also in order that it carry through so that people will continue to tell the story. So either way, we don't know whether Cassius Dio was telling the truth or not, but what we do know is that he was communicating an attitude toward the Jews, that the Jews are the indigestible element of the Roman Empire. And I've pointed out to you that what happens now is that the church, as it adopts the Roman Empire as its body, will quickly adopt that attitude toward the Jews and clothe it in a new language. The Jews are no longer the indigestible element of empire. They're the obstinate refusers of salvation. Right? Because why? Two reasons. First of all, we're no longer in the fight for territorial supremacy. We lost. Although we'll see there's a little bit of a comeback in today's story. But we lost. Well, let's not say we lost. We lost that round. Where are the Romans now, right? We lost that round, but the battleground has become religious. So therefore, who cares if you were the indigestible, you know, element of empire? I want to talk about whether you accept salvation or not. And there, the Jews are no. That's a no. And so therefore, as we'll see, Augustine plays an important role. So that's our problem. The problem is you have widespread hatred of the Jews in Greco-Roman culture. You have a strong element within patristic Christianity who says the solution to the Jews is destruction because we have replaced them theologically, or they are culturally and spiritually a competitor that we want to erase. So how is it that the Romans or the Christians in their combination, the pagans that join the team, don't just simply set about trying to destroy all the Jews? Well, the answer is we do have some evidence that there were what we would today call pogroms, although not to what to the degree you would think. Another answer is don't forget Christianity doesn't take over overnight, right? And furthermore, we talked about with Constantine and the Nicene Council in 325 and the creation of Orthodox Christianity, who was the real receiver of persecution in the wake of the Nicene Council? The other Christians. The Arians were the big one. Their story will come back, right? But the post-Nicene period was the longest period of Christian persecution in all history, and it was the persecution by other Christians, right? That's, remember, when there's heterodoxy, everybody gets a seat at the table. As soon as you have orthodoxy, everything else becomes heresy. And the church, backed by imperial power, is very interested in erasing heresy. Because the simplest explanation for why Constantine, who from the evidence doesn't seem he was so particularly Christian himself, but why would he be interested in Christianity? Because it's a powerful force for empire. The unifying value of religion is something that everybody can get behind. And if you can't, it's also very easy to destroy your enemies. I mean, at least to identify them. Whether you win on the battlefield or not is a different question. So this leaves us now with the theological question before we get to the sociopolitical. What sort of new modus vivendi, sort of way of coexistence, to borrow a term, does the Christian church and Judaism reach? And the answer comes in Augustine of Hippo. He was from Hippo. I know it sounds strange. But it's actually a city in North Africa. So he is, first of all, as I think I mentioned, but it's worth it to review, he is seen by many people as the single most important writer, certainly in patristic Christianity, perhaps in all Christian history. Right? His doctrines, in particular his great work, The City of God, sets a model for Christianity in the Middle Ages. And since the Middle Ages is still the heyday of Christianity, then that means he gets the number one. He gets named as a saint fairly early after his death and is looked to as Now, by the way, if you're one of the great writers of Christianity, what else are you? One of the fathers of Western culture, mm-hmm. right? So Augustine cannot be downplayed as anything other than critical. So I already gave you a couple pieces of his thought. Number one, as opposed to Justin Martyr, and also we mentioned Tertullian, who saw the Jews as intrinsically bad, that it was the very carnal nature, when borrowing that language from apostolic Christianity and Paul, the very physical nature of the Jewish people was just problematic, that we'd gotten it wrong all along, the way of we were serving God was never what God wanted. Remember we spoke about this, and the Jews never understood the scriptures which they held. So Augustine disagrees. He says the Jews were right to keep these things, all the physical practices, because, of course, he's very enamored of the idea of prefiguration, right? As opposed to allegory, which says the Jews never understood the Torah, because the Torah is an allegorical exposition of spiritual ideals, and we shouldn't have been actually sacrificing animals or circumcising our children. We should have been pouring out the blood of the Savior and circumcising the heart. That's allegory, you understand? It's a spiritualization of physical action. Augustine's doctrine is one of prefiguration, which is, no, you should have been doing all those physical things in order that you could bring forth this crowning physical moment that he sees to be the Son of God born on earth. You understand the difference? So therefore, the Jews are meritorious in their time. So he's left with, not the way that he was a Jew lover. There's plenty of what's called contra-Judaeus in his writings. He's very opposed to the Jews, but he doesn't have an intrinsically negative attitude toward the Jews as a physical people, as opposed to Justin Martyr and Tertullian, who are really left only with the desire to destroy the Jews. One second, I want to get his whole picture out. Right? So that's one very important difference. He says that the physical people of Israel stand as a prophet foretelling the coming in the flesh, the suffering in the flesh, and the redemption of the flesh through their Savior. You understand? It's a prefiguration. That basically, who replaces the Jews? No, Jesus of Nazareth. Right? And that, by the way, this is also the time period when the idea of Knesset Yisrael, the sum spiritual total of the Jewish people, is also very present in the rabbinic mind. I told you that there are parallel tracks in the Midrashic thought, and particularly in the thought of the patristic Christianity. They're all dealing with the same problem. What are they dealing with? They have come out of the ancient world where the infinite and the finite could be embodied in a God. You understand? We may give lip service to the idea that the God of Israel is all-powerful, all-knowing, perfect, etc. But if you read the Hebrew Bible, you're not going to come away with that conclusion. Right? And that's exactly what the Christians claim. Oh, you have a petty, the angry Old Testament God. You understand? So the sages are grappling with what they know to be true, which is the perfection, benevolence, and omnipotence of God, and the reality of how God is described in the Hebrew Bible. And they come up with many ways to understand that. And one of the ways they come up with understanding it is what's known as Knesset Yisrael, that there is a spiritual sum total of Israel, which has a direct relationship with God. Right? This comes much later in the Zohar, if you've ever heard the phrase that Kudsh Brichu Raita V'Yisrael Chadhu, that God, Israel, and the Torah are one, which is a much later formulation in the Zohar, but of a much earlier concept. Right? And then what happens to actual physical Israel as individuals? We're expressions of that relationship, insofar as we align ourselves with law in the rabbinic mind and the overarching narrative, so we can be expressions of the relationship between Knesset Israel and God, which is always perfect and always loving, etc., etc. This may sound familiar. What replaces Knesset Israel in that equation for the Christians? Not just the church, but Jesus of Nazareth and the church remaining. It's a funny thing in there. And without supporting the Christian view, it is very important to understand why the Trinity was such an easy sell. Which, by the way, you will find Trinitarian thought in many places aside from Christianity. It's a very simple explanation. Every relationship has a Trinitarian aspect. What do I mean? There's me, there's you, and there's our relationship which exists between us. And the power dynamic of Father, Son, and the spirit that emerges from between them is something that everyone is familiar with in relationships. They're not necessarily using that language. And so the church, in attempting to bridge the finite and the infinite, saw the need for an intermediary. right? And that was a very strong cell, particularly in the pagan world, which didn't have any problem with intermediaries to begin with. The Jews had a bigger problem, and therefore the intermediary becomes alternatively the spiritual nature of Israel, or of course, Torah. Right? Remember, God's voice is gone. What we have is God's word. That's our project now. In fact, if anybody pops up and says, I heard God's voice, what do we do with them? Do to them at this point in history? We get rid of them pretty quick, right? We're not interested in that discourse any longer. We have what God wanted to say to us. It is an internal, so much so that the Gemara, of course, famously, when God pipes up in conversations, what do the sages say? Lo b'shamayim, no, we're done with that. It's not in heaven anymore. We're down here on earth. Yes, prefiguration is the idea that, as opposed to allegory, which means that the way the Jews understood the Torah was wrong, because we were reading it physically, whereas it was meant to indicate spiritual truths. Prefiguration says, no, the physical commands of the Torah were correct, but they were like a play acting, which was going to reach its culmination in the actual Christian story. The best example I can give you is, what? Is the idea of Eliyahu and his whole life, which they see him as a prefiguration of John the Baptist announcing Jesus of Nazareth. That helped the difference? Meaning that the physical historical events were real and significant on their own, but they were like religion 1.0 as opposed to our goal, which is 2.0. The second piece? Listen, I don't want to go too much into Christian doctrine, because I'm not a scholar and it's not our story, but there are many reasons why the Trinity had an appeal. For me, what's important to understand is that its appeal is not purely Christian, which is why in later, particularly in mystic thought, there would be a lot of battles. If people are familiar with the culture that emerges out of Spain, the Trinitarian thought begins to leak into Jewish thought in many places. Yeah? When? His dates are, he was born in 354, and he died in 430. Another question in the corner?
Oh, no, I was just going to say that I thought you meant that, like, prefiguration was the story of the Messiah from our God. The Messiah will come on a white horse or a donkey into the, and that's what did happen. That's how Jesus came into Jerusalem.
It can be that, but what I'm particularly interested in the challenge that the church and the Jews were struggling over is, did the Jews get it right, and that was just a passing phase? Or did the Jews never get it right? Why does that matter? Lamai nafkamina, asked the rabbis as the Christians are arguing about this. Because if we got it right, then there's merit to our continued existence for various reasons we'll get to in Augustine. If we didn't get it right, then we're actually evil, intrinsically evil, and the best thing you can do with us is destroy us. We are demons, and so much of the role that Judaism will play in medieval culture and Christian culture comes from that, even though Augustine wins. So coming back to Augustine, number one, like I said, the Jews were right to do what they did because they allowed the appearance in history of their Savior, number one. Number two, Augustine is enamored, he's fascinated by the fact that the Jews just keep on surviving. And this, by the way, as its echo in rabbinic thought as well, if you're familiar with the Gemara in Yoma that asks the question, why were the men of the Great Assembly so great? Something we spoke about last semester. One of the answers that they give along the way in their analysis is understanding the idea that Israel survives one nation amongst 70. That the survival of Israel is a miraculous event, which is meant to be an indicator of God's continued existence in the rabbinic line. Right? As God continually hides, and we will speak a little bit about the theology of exile today, it's an important part of our story. But as God retreats, in the Bible, God is present. God's a character, so to speak. Right? In the Mishnah and Gemara, not really. It gets cameo appearances, right? But it's not character. So the question, like, where does God go, becomes a very pressing issue in everyone's minds. And so there's a whole theology which emerges from amongst the rabbis of how not only to explain, but to basically make it a powerful positive that God is increasingly not present. And one of the sort of indicators that sages will always point to the continued presence of God in the world, is the survival of Am Yisrael. And in our generation, I think that that's something that we can appreciate on a completely different scale, right? And so therefore, it's noteworthy that Augustine also sees the survival of the Jews as an indication of the divine. Right? Furthermore, and perhaps the most significantly, is, you know, at this point, and now he's only in the 5th century here, but he knows that the Jews are scattered everywhere with their practices and their sacred books. And this is very important and will only become more so. I mean, 5th century is nothing compared to the 12th, you know, 15th, etc. But what's his point? Everywhere you go, you're apt to run into a Jew. And a Jew is noticeable. Why? They look different. They act different. They have these books. Now, why does that matter? Because Augustine realizes the church has a problem. On one hand, we're supposed to have replaced the Jews, right? And he agrees that God has rejected the Jews and chosen the church. He's not, he's not a Philo-Semite, right? On the other hand, the church needs the Jews because the Jews are the proof that their scriptural assertions are true. Remember, and we spoke about this last week, that in the mindset that we're dealing with, everybody agrees that the 5 books of Moses are God-given truth. They're only arguing about how to read it, and the book of Isaiah and the book of Jeremiah, right? And so therefore, those are stories about the Jews, even if you want to argue that the Jews got it wrong. So the best proof you can have that those stories actually happened, and therefore that the church's interpretations of them are not only correct but matter, is the existence of the Jews. If you've ever read the Kuzari, which we'll speak about if we ever get to Spain, right? If you've ever read it, Rabbi Yehuda Levi's great work of Emunah, we'll call it. I don't want to call it philosophy because it's a misnomer. His literary frame is when the king of the Khazars wants to decide what's right in religion, and he brings in a philosopher, an imam, and a priest. It's not like a joke. It's a true, you know. And leaving aside the philosopher, what are both the imam and the priest eventually point to as proof for their revelation? Yeah, it goes back to the Jews. So at the end of the day, he's like, okay, well, bring me a Jew. Like what? You know? So this idea was very present for Augustine. Is that the Christianity has nothing. It can claim to be another better pagan sect if it wants. But if it wants to claim relationship to the one true God, everybody agrees that that comes from the Jews. It's just a debate about where it went from there. And so therefore, on one hand, the church needs to replace the Jews. On the other hand, the church needs the Jews' continued existence. And this is where he comes up with, love it or hate it, a great idea. He says that the Jews will never perish, says Augustine, for the whole length of the 7 days of time. Again, if you're familiar with rabbinic thought, this idea that creation is a 7-day cycle is not just in the book of Genesis, it's also a prediction of a 7,000-year history to the world, right? They make visible to the Christian faithful the subjection they merited because they put the Lord to death. Number one, the misery of the Jews confirms Christian salvation, right? This is what happens. You see these Jews, they're not going away. They're suffering down through time because they rejected salvation. And he quotes, he says, and like God puts a mark on Cain, right? And furthermore, he has what he calls his witness doctrine, right? That the very dispersion of the Jews testifies to 2 things. This is culminating both, or putting them both together. Number one, it testifies to what happens when you reject salvation. Number two, it testifies to the truth of Christian scriptural assertions. So it becomes what's known as the doctrine of the suffering remnant, which expresses itself in the wandering Jew, that the Jews are cursed by God, and he ultimately in the city of God, when he finally sort of culminates or clarifies his whole doctrine, he quotes Tehillim, Psalms 59:12, "Slay them not, lest my people forget; scatter them with your might." Right? Slay them not, lest my people forget. Meaning if you get rid of all the Jews, people will forget what happens when you reject Christianity. Scatter them with their might so that they will be scattered around the world as a witness and a reminder both to the truth of Christian interpretation of Scripture and to the consequences of rejecting, you know, their salvation. And thus, Augustine offers a place for the Jew to exist within Christian culture, subjugated, but not destroyed. Which is why you'll see consistently throughout medieval Christian history, Europe being the home for it, that it is not the church nor the kings who persecute the Jews systematically. Yes, this pope or that nobleman will indeed do horrible things. But actually, you look at the track record, the church and the nobility were interested in keeping the Jew in a miserable subject alive state. It was the mob that would periodically break out. And we'll speak about feudalism and the particular role that the Jew played in the feudal society. Right? Now, again, he wasn't a philo Semite. He didn't love the Jews. Right? Nor did he do this for the sake of the Jews. He wasn't trying to save them. But he was trying to solve a theological problem, and in doing so, he set the stage for the Middle Age. There's one more piece to it, but yeah, question, okay. Comment.
So at this period, is the church interested in the conversion of Jews at all? It doesn't sound like they want
to... The church is absolutely interested in conversion of the Jews. They're interested in conversion of everyone.
Okay.
The later notions that there will be a mass conversion of the Jews has its roots in Augustine. Meaning, you want the Jews to continue to exist as Jews, because then they testify both to the misery of rejecting salvation and to the truth of Christian interpretation.
Well, all the Jews convert, then the prefiguration.
Well, that's the eschatological, the end of days vision part of it, which is that will be part of the second coming, etc. And that takes a while to really get off the ground in Christian thought. He is. He actually says that. Yes, they're very stiff-necked people. Yeah. Well, first of all, every case has to be judged on its own, number one. Number two, there's a good argument to be made that what's happening in Spain was more about political power than religious. Don't forget, and then I'll come back to it, don't forget that the Inquisition as an institution had no power over the Jews. The Inquisition as an institution had power only over converts to Catholicism, and they attacked the Jews directly insofar as they were frightened because they were a Judaizing force, which were drawing these converts back to Judaism. The state, in quotes, because it wasn't a modern state, Ferdinand and Isabella, the kingship, had power over the Jews because in medieval Europe, in reflection of Augustine's doctrine, the Jews will become what's known as serfs of the crown. The Jews will often be the direct, literal, physical possession of the nobility. But that's a discussion if we ever get to Spain. If you want, I'm happy to send you the classes I've given on that here from last year. Okay. There's one more piece for Augustine, but are people clear on the very important distinction that he enters into here and the role? It should already be sounding familiar, those of you who know somewhat about the history of Jews in Europe, how the city of God actually lays the groundwork for that role that the Jew will take. Right? Like Avram said, the wandering Jew, this sort of miserable Jew at the same time, he's got a very important place. He's got a strange status, and we'll speak about the socioeconomic reality of feudalism further down the line. Questions or comments before I add the last piece, which is my personal favorite, right? So do you guys know, we're just in the middle of these parshiot. I really wanted to get to it last week, but you can't win everything, right? Actually, 2 weeks ago, right? That there is no firstborn of any significance in the Torah that inherits. Right? Even though you ask most people, and the idea of the firstborn is a classic ancient, it's a far, not just the Jewish world, I mean, they... worldwide, nevertheless, and in the Torah as well, and the Bechor gets Pishnaim and all that good stuff, and yet when you start to poke away case by case, you realize not one, right, of any significance. I mean, you might be able to find some random person, but, and so where is the origin of that whole story? It was 2 weeks ago in the Parsha when Rivka has this heavy pregnancy and she doesn't know what's going on. She goes apparently to a prophet and she's like, what's happening inside me? And I meant to bring a chumash so I could quote the psukim properly. If you guys, well, yeah, I get it. 1 second, because it's an isser. Actually, just quote that. Right? What? So there's a very important dynamic, which gets revealed in her inner experience, to use a modern term, right? What happens? So she's pregnant, right? And she goes to the prophet to see like what's going on, right? Just looking for the stalling here. Help me out. Here we go. This is missing yes, and I think this is actually. I think this is actually missing a page. No, I got it. I was just looking the wrong place. Here it is. So she goes and asks him, what does it say? Shnei goyim bivitnech, u'shnei lumim mima'ayichi paridu. Two nations in your womb, two separate peoples shall issue from your body. By the way, I won't go into it now, but it's worth noting that the word le'um is the first appearance in the Torah, and it happens three times in this sentence. And modern Hebrew, le'um is what? Nation, nationalism. Le'umiyut is nationalism. And the idea, the aspect of identity, which involves rejection of other, right, has a very important role in nationalism, and it's worth some reflection here. Nevertheless, the key is one people shall be mighty to the other, and the older shall serve the younger. That's the key. The older shall serve the younger. Now, of course, who's born first from Rivka? Esav. Of course, why do we call him Yaakov? He's holding by his heel, right? And the Midrash say, why was he holding by the heel? He was supposed to go out first, and Rashi gives that somewhat graphic explanation that if you took a tube and you put two rocks in, right, the first one you put in, you had to take the second one out, right? So who's really firstborn here? Nevertheless, Esav comes out first. Yaakov, of course, becomes Yaakov Yisrael, were the Jews. Who does Esav become in the rabbinic mind? Rome, which becomes whom?
Christianity.
Interesting. This is where you get what we know as the hermeneutic battle. It's the narrative warfare of who controls the text. Remember, and this is hard for people who don't live in late antiquity and the Middle Ages to appreciate, this is really what matters to these people. Of course, they're still human beings. Power matters. Economics matter. But it matters on a scale that even a religious Jew finds hard to imagine. Right? So they're taking a battle that's taking place inside the text. Now, everybody has the same text. What they're arguing about is, what does it mean? And what they're really arguing about is, who is the older brother? Now, historically speaking, Christianity, Judaism, who's the older brother? The Jews. So it's very easy for Augustine and the rest of the church fathers to say, listen, your scripture says that the elder shall serve the younger. We win. What do the sages say? No, no, no. You're Esau. You're the older brother, and you're going to serve us. Now understand, this isn't just two kids on the playground, you know, trying to make each other feel bad, right? This battle will continue to rage throughout the Middle Ages to this very day. This is a major struggle between Christianity and Judaism, to those that still bother to struggle over it. And it basically comes down to the question of, who's able to tell the right story of the text that will get that will explain the present in a way that it will get us to the future that we actually want to live? Meaning, who has the redemptive story? And if you want to understand a little bit of evangelical Zionism, you should understand, I don't know if people interact with evangelical Zionists all, but it's a scripturally based culture, right? And like, you know, when you see the sort of like almost wide-eyed innocence that I've experienced many times. I said, well, it says, those who bless you shall be blessed. So, like, that's why I'm here. You need to take that seriously. You don't have to buy into it. You need to take seriously that the motivation is genuinely, like, I actually believe the Bible's true, and it says, those who bless you shall be blessed. Now you're thinking, Augustine knew it said, those who bless you shall be blessed. Like, well, why didn't he get that? And the answer is because the hermeneutic battle in their mind has been lost. They lost. You know why they lost? Because where are we sitting right now? Right, the modern state of Israel overturns 1,500 years of hermeneutic battle. Because remember, Augustine said, as long as the Jews are dispersed and lowly, etc., that we can explain why they continue to exist. It fits perfectly, right? Slay them not, lest your people forget, but scatter them in your might, he says. That's what's happening. I can tell the story, says Augustine, and they're the older brother, and they're serving the younger brother. As soon as they're no longer scattered and disparaged, so some deep questions emerge. If you're familiar with Vatican II, right, and the shift of the Catholic Church's theology wasn't only due to the modern state of Israel, but I can go out on a limb and tell you it wouldn't have happened if it weren't for it. There would not have been a reinterpretation. Catholic doctrine, which is replacement theology in its essence, right, that the church replaced the Jews. In 1964, the Pope changed that. It's good to have a Pope, right? He just simply, in his understanding, said, no, God did not abrogate his covenant. Held by the covenant with the church. It wasn't like he gave up and became Jewish. But it was a major shift in Catholic thought, which was a result of interfaith dialogue and, you know, the 60s and all kinds of stuff. But you cannot avoid the reality that he certainly knew Augustine better than I do. And it just simply didn't hold water any longer. Some of them. There are different types of evangelicals. There's the eschatological crew. There's a big question of how much impact the Vatican II actually had on the average Catholic, and that's ways beyond the scope of our story. But you are correct, because there's a big difference. That's the downside of having a pope. Meaning the pope got up there and said, "This is over. We're going to change." He can't change the culture. The evangelical world is a bottom-up culture. So, meaning, it's got all kinds of, there are people who, it's not such a good motivation, their love for the Jews, you know? There are others who have just genuinely, like, we're on the Jew team. There are others that it's actually neoconservative politics dressed up in religion. There's all kinds of religion reasons. But it's a grassroots, so therefore you can genuinely say that a person who espouses it isn't because he's been told to, but it's because it's come from more of the bottom up. Even though, of course, there's still leadership models, etc. But my point is, I want you to appreciate the power of this battle. This is the hermeneutic battle. Again, what's that? Who has the proper reading of the text in the present that will get us to the redemption we dream of in the future? And of course, there's no way to answer that question. The church over the next 1,500 years will say, who has the right reading? We do. What's the proof? Well, look at yourself, Jew. Your temple's been in ruins for 500 years, 1,000 years, 15, 16. When was the last time you were in Jerusalem? Uh-huh, right? So, and furthermore, can we close that door, please? Furthermore, we will get, as we will trace in the Middle Ages, these periodic debates. Right? If people are familiar with the great debate of the Ramban, or the burning of the Talmud in Paris in the 13th century. Like, there are some classic moments of doctrinal dispute, but it all comes down to who owns the story. Right? This problem, by the way, doesn't go away in our generation. We are still waging a narrative war. More so today than ever, because of the nature of media and the nature of public opinion, et cetera, you know, the narrative battlefield today is consciously a front in all struggles, right? And so for the Jews, it really has its, I don't know about its origins, but it has its strongest period of formation here with Augustine showing clearly that the only way you can justify the continued existence of the Jews is through your interpretation of their own scriptures, and that has to reflect itself in history. As long as the Jews are lowly and scattered, then my reading is right, says Augustine, which, of course, the average feudal lord will take as a permission to keep them lowly and scattered, right? But as soon as they're no longer, like now you've got a completely different situation. We're going to get to Islam, because Islam, and we'll get to them, if not today, then certainly next week. Islam is a slightly different issue, because remember, Islam does not claim to be the Jews. So our issues are, there are real there, but they're different. In my opinion, the primary issue with Islam is sociopolitical, not religious. Not that that makes it easier necessarily, but it's I see religion as a much higher potential for peace between the Jews and the Muslims than politics. Yeah?
Why don't we care?
Because we want to win. Okay, so that's an important question. Why do we care? I would say that very question is premised on a free democratic society. I mean, we care in the Middle Ages because it's not a free democratic society and the church has power, right? And obviously I was giving you a facetious answer, somewhat. But also there's a big question of what's our mission. Don't forget that one of the big differences between Christianity and Judaism, which is worth revisiting here, and then I'll do a little summary and we'll move into this homeland, holy land difference, right, is that Judaism, we'll start with the church, Christianity, certainly patristic Christianity, is a universalist, exclusive worldview. What do I mean? It's universalist. Everyone is invited to join the community of the faith. But it's exclusive. If you don't, you're going to hell. Islam will take the same stance. The idea, Islam has a more sociopolitical view. The ummah, the community of the faith, everyone is welcome to join the ummah, or is forced to join it. If you don't, you're what's known as Dar al-Harb. You're the world of the sword, right? So that's the universalist exclusive. And if you note, all the way through modernity, universalist movements will have that exclusive element. That's what often strikes people as strange about the intolerance that exists at the edge of nominally liberal movements, and how the Jew often plays a very strange role in that intolerance, which you may be sensing today. It's because it's a homogenizing universalism. We are universalists as long as everybody is the same, or at least has some unifying factor. I don't want to overstate. The Jews, on the other hand, are a particularist, inclusive worldview. Meaning what? We're the Jews, and you're not. And we're not even particularly interested in you joining the team, despite the fact that around about this time period is when that switches. Right? However, you don't have to be a Jew. Not, you don't have to be a Jew to live. You don't have to be a Jew to have a relationship with God. Okay, we could get into the whole chosen thing and what's the nature of the relationship, etc. It's not simple. I don't want to, you know, downplay the challenges of Jewish particularism. Nevertheless, you understand how that's a different model of universalism. It's what eventually could become what's called the ecosystem model, which is that the ecosystem model. Ecosystem, right? No, not ego, eco with a C. Meaning, if you go out into a healthy field, you have diversity. And that's not just like a fuzzy, you know, buzzword of today. That's actually what causes it to be healthy. You don't want it. The pine trees don't want everything to be pine trees, right? The grasses don't want everything to be grasses. By the way, in a living system, when one part of the system wants to take over and make everything like itself, you know what we call it? Cancer. Yeah, God forbid, but your liver decides everything should be liver. It doesn't go well, right? And so the potential then is to hold up a model, and this is why we care, is that our vision of redemption does not involve the whole world becoming like us. When we read this text, the goal is not, when I say victory, that we sit on top of the world and everyone is subject to our world. Read the end of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. What are we looking for? We're looking for the space so that we can serve God. And let the world be well ordered, as the Rambam says, right? The good things of the world will be like the dust of the earth, and everybody will be, there'll be no more war, no more competition. No, and finally, we'll be able to sit and learn, says the Rambam, and I won't have to worry about all these Mishukayim that are making my life difficult, right? So that's a very different model than, say, Christianity or Islam. And that's another reason why it matters even in our day, which is that you still have half the planet that looks to this book as a sacred story, whatever that may mean for them in particular. Therefore, I do believe it's very important for the Jews to continue the hermeneutic battle in ways which, by the way, cause a lot of internal tension within Am Yisrael, because not every Jew would agree with what I just said.
You don't have to be a Jew to go to heaven, according to that.
No, for sure not.
They're very explicit about that, as opposed to either.
Right, and we can get into debates about what does it mean and how does it look, and frankly, I don't get into debates about what it looks like when you go to heaven, because you know why? How am I supposed to know? Right, meaning there's enough within our scriptural readings and our rabbinic tradition to make space for everyone except pagans. You know, it's very interesting. You know how the Meiri, 14th century French thinker, Rishon, you know how he describes paganism? It's interesting because you look in the Gemara, and the sages of our time period, they're looking around at the pagan world. And they say all kinds of stuff. Like, we all know you're not allowed to worship Avodah Zarah, you're not allowed to benefit from Avodah Zarah. But when the Meiri looks, you know what he notices? There's a distinct lack of theology in the Gemara. They're not so interested in what the pagans believe. You know what they're worried about with the pagans? Right, you can't let them cut your hair because they might slit your throat. You don't go alone on a raft with them because they might rape you. You don't lend them your animals for reasons that we don't need to discuss, right? And so what the Meiri comes to a very simple conclusion. He says, oh, what the sages are worried about is anyone who lacks dat v'nimus, dat without an ayin. They have no religion or culture. They're uncivilized. He says that's what the Gemara forbids. And he makes a huge leap and says, and therefore, anyone who has dat v'nimus is not under the category of a pagan. Which, crazy, but you could lead you to a situation where today you are part of a nominally monotheistic religion, but you are willing to kill men, women, and children without regard, and you are therefore a pagan. And you might actually, in your spare time, bow to small stone idols, but if you're a law-abiding citizen who just happens to like to do their religious thing, you would not be. It's a very different perspective, and I only bring it now to point out that our tradition actually has a lot of richness in how we can relate to the world as a whole, except for people who want mayhem. There you will find no space. Mayhem. Mayhem. Murder and destruction without regard to life. Because we're convinced that what God wants is life. Okay, so this is the hermeneutic battle, and it's going to follow us going forward. And it's important to me that that's where we sort of pause our story of Christianity, because it's going to define our relationship for the next 1,500 years. Questions or comments on that before we shift gears to what's actually physically happening in the land of Israel at this point? No? Come on, I don't believe that for a second. I said questions or comments before we move on. I mean, listen, if you guys are being serious, I'll move on. But my experience is that sometimes it takes a little time to digest. Okay. Yeah, Abram.
All right, so Christianity, though, we should look at it as monolithic. We know the Arians. Christianity is having its own
inner discourse.
Identify itself.
It's a very important point you're making, that Christianity is certainly not monolithic today or then. Nevertheless, for the Jewish story, what's happening is the emergence of Orthodox Christianity. Small o, meaning because we're going to get a split into an Eastern Orthodox Church and Catholic coming up. And the place where the Christians are united is in their opposition to the Jews. And what's going to matter is that Augustine, even though you're correct, Augustine is just one voice amongst many in the 5th century, although an important one. What happens, however, is the impact of the City of God, of his major literary work, on once the Catholic Church and Rome and the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, right, becomes the central religious figure of Europe. So Augustine's thought will serve as the spiritual and theological basis for the formation of Europe. And since that is the context for so much of the European Jewish story going forward, so with the caveat that you are correct, there is no monolithic thought here, nevertheless, it serves as a good base for it. At this point in history? Now I don't want to talk about now. Maybe yes, maybe no. It's not so clear to me today that people are moving away from religion. Certainly not in America.
You haven't seen much about Jesus.
We never met. Sorry. I couldn't resist. For some reason, you bring out my sarcastic side. Well, I haven't said much about Jesus, and in what context?
The Christian story.
Right. That's because, frankly, we did last semester. Meaning, I'm picking up in patristic Christianity. I gave a little bit of an introduction to apostolic Christianity last class, the Christianity that of the apostles, of people who actually knew Jesus of Nazareth. And his own story I embedded actually in a much earlier period where our sages place it in the Hellenistic period. So yeah, I apologize. I'm happy to send you material on it, but I can't go that far back right now. Other questions or comments?
Is that why the Tanakh is so important and so much studied by the Christians, maybe less than by the Jews?
Is this why the Tanakh is so important and so studied by the Christians? That's also a complex answer. A lot of that in today has more to do with the split between the Protestants and the Catholics than it has to do with our relationship to the Jews. That's the short answer. And the reason the Jews don't study it has a lot to do with the Haskalah and et cetera. But it's an important question that we'll deal with if we ever get to the Protestant Reformation. Anything else? Okay, so we're going to just switch gears, although it's a related topic. But before we do, I actually have to explain what's going on here. Well, you know what? I'll fill in some more some socio-political information, and then I'll end on the more philosophical note. Okay, so from the homeland to the Holy Land, right? This is always irks me, by the way, when Jews call Israel the Holy Land, right? And I'll tell you why. You know, there's a famous story which may or may not be true, but Rav Tzvi Yehuda, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen's cook's son, was once traveling by boat back to Eretz Israel. He'd been in Europe, teaching, raising money, I have no idea. And he met a group of Christians who were extremely excited to be going to the Holy Land. And he asked them why. And they said to him, well, our God died there, right? And he paused for a minute and smiled. He said, our God lives there. Right? And aside from the humor value, that is the essence of the difference that we're speaking about here. Is that the idea of the Holy Land is a disembodied religious point of pilgrimage, right? And the idea of a homeland is a place where you actually live. What's the difference? I don't know how long you guys have been here, but I came to Israel 17 or so years ago, right at the height of the Second Intifada, which if you were here, you probably recall that anybody who wasn't actually nailed down to the country was gone, and certainly tourists weren't coming, right? And I remember speaking to my mom about this, and my mom at the time, who has been a communal leader in the Jewish world for 3 or 4 decades, pointed out that she'd been complaining about the fact that this is the Jewish Disneyland. Right? It's a place where the Jews come for their Jewish experience. And as she pointed out, when they start shooting at people in Disneyland, you go to Six Flags. Right. You're not pushing your way through the armed front to get to Space Mountain. Right? So the challenge of the Holy Land is that it's disembodied. And as a spiritual point of pilgrimage, you put up with a lot more at home than you would on a vacation. Why? Because home is real. It's gritty. It's full, etc. A vacation is somewhere where you're trying to push all that aside and get something very specific. And so how does the land of Israel become the Holy Land? Well, first of all, it really in many ways goes back to Constantine. Remember, Constantine as emperor is the first one to legitimize and then institutionalize Christianity in the Roman Empire, even though it's not until Theodosius in 380 that Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. Constantine in 325 has that Nicene Council that he brings. It's the first ecumenical council. He puts the force of empire behind getting a creed of Orthodox Christianity. Now, we spoke about that already, but what I want to add to is that there at the council was his mother, the Empress Helena, depending on how you want to pronounce her name, who was also pagan turned Christian, although apparently, unlike Constantine, she meant it. Right? She was super excited about being Christian. And one of the delegates to the Nicene Council was Bishop Macarius of Aelia Capitolina. Aelia Capitolina is where? It's Jerusalem. It was still called Aelia Capitolina since Hadrian, Yamach Shemo, had destroyed it and rebuilt it. And she spoke at length with the bishop. And he, clever man that he was, put on a really sad face about how awful it was that places hallowed by the steps of their Savior were sitting in neglect. And so at the end of the council, sure enough, she went on a building mission. She left for Jerusalem, equipped with not only the blessings and authority of her son, but also his funding. Right? And it was Helena who came to the land of Israel on the voyage of discovery and marked out most, if not all, but most of the critical places that to this day are hallowed by the church as sacred in the life of Jesus of Nazareth. For instance, the monastery that's in Emek HaMatzleba, right, next to Gan Sachar, that big old monastery, which is the point where they claim that the true cross was cut, was built by her. She located the Church of Nativity in Beit Lechem. She located what's it called? Thank you, that was what I was saying. I'm so glad you knew exactly what I was talking about. The Holy Sepulchre, the Stations of the Cross. Apparently, in the reading I've done, it was more like, have you ever seen somebody with a divining rod? Yeah. No, I'm not being facetious. Like, apparently, there was like a spiritual group of them that went around, and the bishop, of course, had his ideas of where things were. And let's not forget, I mean, this is the early 4th century. So Nehi will take the Christian narrative that all these things really happened the way that the Christian scriptures say they happened. So it's pretty reasonable to believe that the people in Jerusalem would have held fast to the traditions of where these sites actually were. I'm not going to get into the theological arguments about that, just sociologically speaking. And by the by, I would point out that, you know, people in revealed religions shouldn't throw stones. Because if you really try to dig away at the history of most of the sites that the Jews hold to be sacred in the land of Israel, you will discover two sources for the vast majority of them. You know what they are? The Arizal, who in the 16th century was really into asking the angels where people were buried, because that was very important to the Kabbalistic spot, right? And the Ramban, who when he arrived here in the 13th century was not the Arizal, he didn't ask the angels, he asked the Arabs. So you know, it's important to respect tradition and also to ask questions when the time be. We will speak next week about how we know where the Temple Mount is. Because, by the way, the Christians did everything they could to erase it. Right? It, the physical loss of the Temple Mount was a very important effort for the Byzantine Christians. So Helena comes, And she founds these traditions of all the main Christian sites that are followed to this day. She notes that the Jews have their foothold primarily in the Galil up north and in the Golan. Tiberia is the main Jewish city at this point and will remain so for quite some time. And basically, the Christianization of Israel and the transformation, as I said, from homeland to Holy Land is going to continue under the rule of the Eastern Roman Empire, which really becomes known as the Byzantine Empire. You could ask when. Let's say that Rome gets sacked most significantly in the year 476. Right, that's the 480, the last Western Roman Empire abdicates. A barbarian takes the throne and swears allegiance to the Byzantine Emperor in Constantinople. And that's usually considered to be the end of the Western Roman Empire, right? So you could say, properly speaking, the Byzantine Empire, instead of calling it just the Eastern Roman Empire, comes into being in 480. You know, and that stuff is not so critical for me what date. But you have to understand that process of Christianization continues for the next almost 200 years. It's going to be interrupted by, ultimately it's going to be interrupted by what? Islam, the advent of Islam. Right? Not Arabs, because remember, there are many Christian Arabs at this point. It's Islam, meaning, yes, they will be carried in by the Arabs, but there are what are called the Ghassanids. There's a whole, many Christian Arab tribes that are allied with the Byzantine Empire at this point. So it's important to make the distinction between religion and race, nation, whatever you want to call it. What does it mean that you're an Arab? But there's a very interesting and poorly known interim period in the Persian period, which I wanted to just speak about briefly, because even though, first of all, it's just a fun story, and you can impress your friends with your random knowledge, but also because it actually has a small but significant impact on the Jewish story as a whole. So Helena begins this process of the disembodiment from the homeland to the Holy Land. And anyway, Am Yisrael, as we'll speak about at the end of the class, is undergoing this process of abstraction. Notice, I mean, the Christians are talking about the Jews as an idea, and they're struggling with our existence as a physical entity, right? And this idea of using the Jews as a concept as opposed to as a physical essence will become a hallmark of Christian thought and European thought. And I would argue, by the way, to this day, even secular Western thought has a hard time relating to the Jew as an actual item as opposed to an idea. Mm-hmm. So especially when we step out of line and we don't act like we're supposed to. There is, in Christian rule, a very brief period of Persian resurgence. If people have ever done any archaeology here in Jerusalem, you know there's a Persian period in the early 7th century. It's usually dated around 614. Funny, brief story from the city of David, where I have a close association, is that the largest find of gold to this date in the city of David is from the Persian period. Right? It was a cache of coins which were worth, the gold itself was worth over $1 million. Which means the gold itself in weight was worth over $1 million, which if you can think about it, coins from the 7th century, of course, their primary value is not in the weight of gold. It's in their object value, right? And so therefore, is a huge find. How did it happen? There was a super annoying tourist girl who kept bothering the archaeologists at this dig, and they finally literally said to her, like, why don't you just go dig over there in the corner, where they were like, she'll be there forever. So sure enough, a half hour later, I've heard this from the archaeologist. She's screaming, oh, I got her. They're like, oh, no, would you go? No, I'm not going. You go figure it out. So finally, they send something over there, and he's like, oh, my goodness. The biggest find of gold ever in Jerusalem from the Persian period, which they assume was stashed in the wall there because of why? Because there was a Jewish revolt against the emperor Heraclius, right? And it was part of what's known as the Byzantine-Sasanian War, which happened basically between the years 602-628, right? The Byzantine Empire had picked up from the Roman Empire its opposition to the Persian Empire. The Persians at this point were still mostly what are known as Manichaeans. They'd moved on from classic Zoroastrianism to like a really, really solid dualist worldview, which had a lot of deep influence on Christianity and Judaism as well, but less. But basically, their wars weren't religious wars. Their wars were territorial, economic, political wars, right? And it's the same war. Don't forget that Eretz Israel is sitting right on the boundary of East and West. It's worth repeating. In ancient times, it was Egypt and Assyria, right? In sort of classic Hellenistic times, it was Greece and Persia. And then when the Greek world broke up, it was the Seleucids and the Ptolemaics, right? And then when Rome came on the scene, it was Rome and Parthia. And now you have Byzantium and the Sasanians. And then you have America and Iran. You get this picture, right? There's something about this land where the people who was meant to dwell alone happens to be put that seems to be in the middle of everything. And there's a consistent theme in our history that needs to be reflected on. Because if I were God, not that I am, but if I were, and I wanted people to dwell alone, I probably would have put them in the Gobi Desert. But he didn't. Yeah, or Canada would have been better, true. Actually, I love Canada. You've got my vote. So anyway, what happens is that there's this revolt, which is really the last serious attempt by the Jews to gain any autonomy in the land of Israel prior to the modern state, right? And it relates to the story of Christianity because this is, I can't even say his name, Shahbaraz, the Persian, made a push to drive the Byzantines out of the land of Israel, and the Jews rose in revolt in support of him, right? And in fact, the Persian army, reinforced by the Jews, led by Nehemiah ben Hushiel and Benjamin of Tiberia, marched on Jerusalem and captured it without resistance. Right? In the year 614, the Jews returned to Jerusalem. Not only that, there's evidence that they may have begun sacrifice again, and that Nehemiah ben Hushiel, who became the governor of Jerusalem, began making plans for the rebuilding of the third temple and checking the genealogy of the priests to re-begin the Avodah. Now, this is in the early 7th century. By the way, as a side note, if you've ever sat in shul on the 9th of Av and listened closely to the liturgical poetry, the piyutim that are recited, the keynotes, the poems of mourning, which, granted, are not so easy to follow, you may have noticed that many, many of them come from the Byzantine era. So a bit of a debate about who Eliezer HaKalir was, but the scholars, as opposed to the people who claim that he was a Tana, one of the authors of the Mishnah, the scholars say he was from the Byzantine era. And one of the hallmarks of both his and other of the keynote is the structures of the keynote that follow the Mishmarot, that follow the 24 families of the Kohanim, right? Now just think about that. And they're located also geographically through the lands of Israel. First of all, why am I talking about this? Second of all, what am I talking about? Just imagine in the 7th century that there's enough of a tradition that the Kohanim not only know their families, but they know the cities that they were obligated to. They've preserved this knowledge, and there's reason to believe that that knowledge was reinforced by this very brief but very passionate sense, we're making a comeback. I mean, you have to be careful with Zionist historiography. The Zionists don't tell this story. Why not? Because Mina Tanakh El HaPalmach, from the Bible to Ben-Gurion, it was all exile. We were weak. We were defenseless. We were helpless. We were outside of history. And certainly, even though, of course, it was critical to claim we were always minimally present in the land, we didn't make any real comebacks, and certainly not to build the third temple. That's awkward, right? And so this story doesn't get a lot of attention, although I do believe it deserves some, and not just because it's fun, because you understand that this spirit of the Maccabees, what I've defined for you as this notion that the control, the sovereignty over geography is critical to our divine mission, just keeps popping up. It just keeps popping up. And here's another great example. It was short-lived. Why? Because after a few months, there was a Christian revolt. Nehemiah ben Hushiel and his 16 righteous, as they were called, who ruled the city, were killed and hung from the walls. However, there was a bit of a push back, and the Jews for a little while retook the city and slaughtered the Christians, according to the Armenian bishop and historian Sebios, I have written down here. What's interesting is another historian records that 434,518 prisoners were massacred near the Mamila Reservoir, right? Now, you're thinking that's 4,500 people is a lot, right? Well, guess what? Roni Reich, one of the major archaeologists in the city of Jerusalem, he also works over at the Ur David, he's a very nice guy, in the late 80s, I think in 89 I wrote down in my notes, actually discovered a mass grave exactly where Antiochus said that it would be, and the remains were in poor condition, but it was a minimum of over 500. Yeah, yeah, you guys have been there?
Yeah.
So meaning there's archaeological evidence that indeed, if not the scale, then certainly the act itself did occur. And this is something to keep in mind, that, and because the evidence is that the Jews bragged about this. That they went around and told the Persians, yeah, we killed them all. And like, let us into Tyre, and we'll kill them there too. Because there's a cultural war going on between Christianity and the Persians that the Jews want to take a very clear side on, which is not necessarily pro-Persian, but certainly anti-Christian, right? And as we'll see, actually, it plays itself out somewhere a little bit further away as well. But how does that story end? That's how it really matters to us, because unfortunately, at this point in history, the story never ends well for the Jews, right? Because they had hoped that the Persian emperor would actually give them the land of Israel in exchange for their support of his revolt against the Byzantines, but we apparently were just too few to really matter, either because there were a growing number of Christians within the Persian Empire, or simply because it just was not strategically expedient. But either way, in 1617, the Persians reversed their policy, and they actually sided with the Christians against the Jews, right? And at this point, the Byzantine emperor... What?
No, I was going to say,
why am I not surprised? At this point, the Byzantine emperor Heraclius made a comeback himself, re-entered the country around 630, decimated the remaining Jews. The story is that he actually swore to the Jews of Jerusalem that he would not harm them if they made peace with him, and then he turned his back on them and betrayed them. It's what's known as the Oath of Heraclius, although there are scholars say that doubt that ever happened. It doesn't matter for us whether it really happened. What happened was the end of this revolt was devastating for the Jews, right? That this is the point at which further Jews were banned from settling in or around Jerusalem. The small Beit Knesset synagogue that had been built on the Temple Mount, which is important. Why does that matter to us? Because it shows that they had some idea of where the Temple Mount was still, right? Was destroyed, and the Jews were expelled. They say from within a 3-mile radius. General massacre of the Jewish population, which devastated even the Jewish communities of the Galilee and the Golan, right? This is the point at which the sense that Israel was empty of Jews really began to set in, right? That the Christians had fought for the Holy Land and won, and that the Jews were the ones that paid the price in the long run, right? Furthermore, interestingly enough, according to the scholars that I was looking at, that... the events of this sort of Persian-Byzantine struggle, and then, of course, what comes after it, because if the Christian Empire, the Byzantines, returned in 630, you know who's going to come along within a decade? Islam, right? I mean, the Christians assumed they were there to stay. But by 638, Umar was at the gates of Jerusalem. This is a story that we'll tell, I guess, next week. But these events actually... inspire a number of the sort of apocalyptic Jewish writings from the Middle Ages. There are a number of very interesting books, the Scrolls of Zerubbabel and others, right? And what it did was it helped popularize the idea of a Mashiach ben Yosef and a Mashiach ben David, that there was a war Messiah who comes to pave the way, and that there was ultimately the Redeemer who would then inherit the kingdom. Now, it's an idea which you can trace very easily back even to the relationship between the sons of Leah and the sons of Joseph. People are familiar with that tradition. And certainly it's often pointed to the relationship between King Shaul and David, right, where Shaul clearly creates a kingdom, and David is the one who steps in as king, as opposed to Shaul, who starts as a farmer. Right? Nevertheless, as a messianic concept, and this is an important sort of thread in the Jewish story, where do these messianic concepts come from? And why do they matter, right? And here we have, because what could the message have been of this failed revolt and the destruction of the remnant Jewish community within the land of Israel? Well, if that's what it eventually was, but what conclusion could have easily been drawn here?
Really, that God doesn't give us anymore.
Give up. Either give up in the religious sense of just stick to your religious thing, and the whole land question of embodied Jewish life will exist in some future miraculous temple descending, right, from heaven. Or, even worse, give up for real and join the Christians, right, because God's not with us anymore. And indeed, by the way, the story is that I just lost his name. It just leaked out of my head. I hate when that happens. It'll come back to me in 1 second as soon as I see it. Ah, thank you. Not Nehemiah ben Chushiel, who died on the walls of Jerusalem, but there is a story that Benjamin of Tveria, who was his ally, converts to Christianity when the emperor arrives. I mean, there is, you see both these elements, but the idea of taking your fighting chance lives on, which again is often, I even hear said, that ended with Bar Kokhba, and it did. With rabbinic literature, it definitely ended with Bar Kokhba. But something that's always important to remember is that religious thinking has never been sufficient for the Jews. You know, people have a tendency to believe that up until modernity, we were religious, and that was enough. That's what we wanted. Along came these kids who broke away from tradition, and they couldn't find any other way to find their satisfaction, and they fell into nationalism, and then next thing you know, right, they're dancing around the streets of Jerusalem. Right? Which, I mean, there's some truth to that story, but my point is that you can make an argument that the way we construe religious thinking in the sense of an abstract, disembodied set of beliefs, behaviors, and practices that are practiced on the communal level has never been sufficient for the Jews. There's always been a desire to be part of a larger movement, and that the land of Israel is at the center of it. You'll see it here. You'll certainly see it in the Shabtai Tzvi movement. You know, you can see it in other places as well. I don't want to drag you through random spots of history. And so therefore, which is one of the reasons that Zionism, aside from the reasons in world culture, actually finds a very fertile ground for its ideas, is that there's a strong sense, and this may sound familiar today, that religion is a necessary but insufficient organizing principle for the fullness of Am Yisrael. The Jew works very well with religion. Am Yisrael finds it inadequate as a vessel for full expression. I mean, they were planning to rebuild the temple. That's not even fervor. We'll get to the after they lost story when we get to the next phase in Europe. But I want you to appreciate that what's happening here on one hand is Christianity, this transformation from homeland to Holy Land, and the emptying of the Jewish population out of the land of Israel. On the other hand, a renewed attachment to the idea of embodied life in the land of Israel through the Persian period, right? And soon the advent of Islam. So Am Yisrael, and through all this, as we're going to speak about, right, is the growth of rabbinic culture, which is constructing and elaborating at this point the portable homeland.
You mentioned about the three things going on. Throughout that time, in the next few hundred years, was there always some habitual group of Jews?
Yes, mostly around in the Galilee. What's the name of the family? The Zanati family here in the land of Israel. I actually happen to know the Zanati family based in the city of Tzipori. No, sorry, Pekin. Pekin. Right, they trace their direct, not just their lineage, but their direct residence to the Second Temple. And I know one of the members of the family. They've got very good documentation that their family has always been present in the land of Israel. At the same time, it gets to be a very narrow thread. The Crusades are coming. Right, and on top of this, the Crusades will be devastating. There'll be a resurgent under Islam, as we'll speak about. There'll be a major resurgence coming. Oh yeah,
the
fair.
It's a. But
that's what they said. Yeah, the Pekin Jews, the Zanati family in particular, is the only one I know of that can actually claim uninterrupted residence in the land of Israel since the time of the Second Temple. Pekin. How's it spelled in English? I don't know. We can talk about it later.
P-E-K-I-I-N.
There you go. Okay. So what I want to do now, instead of launching into Islam, which is just going to be a whole sort of it's a whole other thing. We'll just call it that. It's a whole other kettle of fish. There, I'll take that. What I want to do is give another frame for what's happening at this point in history and what we'll pick up next week with Islam. And what that frame is to me has to do with what I call the theology of exile. Right? The Am Yisrael has to deal on some level with the question of exile. We've mentioned this before. Right? I pointed out to you that failure seems to be a dominant theme within the Hebrew Bible from the time that God says, don't eat that fruit, and Adam says, oops, I did it anyway. Right? And so it raises a bunch of questions about what is the role of failure in creation. Right? Are we inside of the failure? Or is there some other way to understand failure as a positive? It's something we spoke about if you guys were around during the Yom Ha'atzmaut, during the high holidays, particularly in the lead up to Yom Kippur. That's sort of the theological textual question. The national historical question is, how do we understand exile? As a people who has spent the majority of its national history not in its land, right? Wow, what is the role that exile plays? Right? Now that's the 2020 hindsight question, because now here we are in our land again asking that question, and there's a struggle within Am Yisrael culturally and geographically. But it's a deeper question of like, what happens when the temple gets destroyed? And in the first temple, major crisis. I'm not going to go all the way back there. Don't be nervous. Right? Second temple, also major crisis. Like, what? How do we understand the nature of the world in which we live and the role that exile plays? And frankly, what God wants of us? So, like I said, I'm not going to drag us all the way back through each stage, but just want to hit the high points so you understand what I'm speaking about. After the destruction of the first temple, the piece of the theology of exile that needs to be taken away is that somehow God's absence is an expression of intimate presence. Right? When God disappears as a character, right? That's the biblical God. And what comes forward is God's word and ideas. It would be very easy to say either that God is dead or God has abandoned us. If you've read the book of Ezekiel, right? That's what the Jews come to Ezekiel and say, well, that's it, it's over. We're going to serve the pagans like everyone else. And he says, oh, no, you're not. Right? But the theology of exile which emerges is that God's hiding of his face is actually an expression of his awesome presence. Right? His forbearance in not destroying the wicked, right? The ongoing survival of Am Yisrael. If you find that strange, I'll just give you the model of a parent and child, which is that any parent that wants their child to succeed knows at a certain point you have to let them fail. That a constant helicoptering style of parenting creates a child who is unable to do anything. And so therefore, as a parent recedes, so the child can actually emerge. Now, there's a balance there. We didn't get into it too much. But that's really the piece of the theology of exile that was offered by the transition into the Second Temple period, even though it wasn't totally gone. Right? We saw already in the sages, in the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple, was this construction of the portable homeland. Right? And this idea that there is a conversation which lies at the heart of Torah, which transcends time and space. Now, it has its anchor in the land of Israel, but both from a pragmatic standpoint, what are you going to do? We're in exile. And also from a more global theological standpoint, which is, wow, there's only one world. One world, one God means that we have to actually be able to bind the whole world together with God, which is that is going to happen. We're going to take this conversation everywhere, meet everybody, encounter everything, and we'll all get incorporated into the portable homeland. I mean, one of the amazing things about the halachic system is that it can deal with anything. Even if it's dealing with it is by saying, no, that's not for us. That's a measured decision. We have the sort of means and the capabilities to ask the question in complex fashions, engage the issue. Yes, no, maybe, sort of, however it works out. You understand? That's an astounding accomplishment for a group of people who lived in late antiquity in the Near East. Right? And so the ability to have a conversation which transcends time and space opens up an image of exile which is not an accident of history, but might actually be an a priori. If you're familiar with the Midrashim that speak about exile as a process of gathering, later in the language of the Arizal, of gathering the sparks, but gathering the gold from the world, gathering the souls, that Israel only went into exile in order to find the souls of the Jews that had been scattered amongst the nations. All this image is an image of dispersion being a precursor to tying the world back together. Right? That becomes a very important part of the theology of exile in late antiquity, and when the Gemara begins to actually spread out through the world. And I want to give you an image that goes with it, and two models of understanding history and how they relate to redemption, which really matter today. In order to do that, first I'm going to tell you a story. It's a story some of you guys may have heard from me. I apologize if you had. But when my second daughter came home from Ghana for the first time and said she wanted to give a Dvar Torah at the Shabbat table, you can imagine how ecstatic we were, right? So she said, okay, all I need is a glass of water, some oil, and a fork. No, she's six, so we're a little nervous, like, what's going on here? But no, she said, Dvar Torah, this is why I moved to the land of Israel. Great, let's do it. So we're there at Friday night table, give her the glass of water and the oil, she pours the water into the oil, she takes the fork, she starts to stir it up, and then suddenly you can hear the ganenet, right? Just like water doesn't mix with oil, so too the Jewish people don't mix with the nations of the world. So first of all, my wife and I are looking, that's like 30 years of liberal education out the window, by gone. Number one. Number two, I became fascinated by what was actually happening in the cup. No, because it's important. It's true, oil doesn't mix with water. We all know that. But you know what happens actually when you do mix it around? It's not like you end up with a layer of water and a layer of oil. What do you end up with? Yeah, you know what that's called? It's called an emulsion. You end up with little globs of oil surrounded by water. And I had this realization that that's what exile is. That's the period of time we're at. See, so long as Israel was in its land and you had some national center, you could make an argument that there were like a layer of Jews and a layer of non-Jews, even though, as we've seen, that's not so clear. Nevertheless, exile begins as this mixing force. Eventually, it's going to be in a blender, but you cannot make oil and water mix. What you can do is fragment the oil into ever smaller pieces. Now, what makes the oil hold together? Two things. One is internal cohesion. The other one is that it's hydrophobic, right? Meaning what holds the oil together is the fact that it likes to be with the ones that are like it, and the other one is it doesn't want to be with the other. And these are the two forces that define Jewish culture in exile, right? And by the way, just scroll forward 1,000 years from our history, and you're going to end up with Polish Jews who will look at the Spanish Jews that show up after the expulsion from Spain and say, funny, you don't look Jewish. Right? Why? Because there's been an internal cohesion that has kept them together as Jews, but that hydrophobia and their difference in their historical arc makes them look very different. And the thing about an emulsion is it's not so easy to get those little bits of oil to form back together into their own layer. We have to do... Oh, no, they don't just go back together. There's two ways to get rid of an emulsion if you want to go far enough with this story, and it matters. There's two ways, and you'll, by the way, you'll see them in later Messianic and Zionist philosophies. You know how you do it? One way is settling. Settling. If you leave that there long enough, water will eventually evaporate and break up, right? But that's a risky proposition for the Jews. If what we say is what we need is a little bit of quiet time just to work it out on our own, that hasn't gone well for us. You know what the other way is? A surfactant. A surfactant, soap, or you know, if you ever have an oil spill in the ocean, they spray surfactant on. You know what surfactant does? It gets rid of the hydrophobia. The solution to pollution is dilution, right? That the way to get rid of an emulsion is to actually just absorb into the whole, right? And in fact, you will see that these are the two primary thought processes that drive messianic and secular messianic thinking of how it is we're going to solve the problem of exile. Are we going to get back to our land and settle and finally become cohesive again with all the problems? I'll get you in a second, right? Or are we going to come up with some solution that will allow us to finally just disperse and stop being different to begin with, and that's the cause of all the problems? Who knew my daughter was that smart? At six, mind you. What? It for sure happens to other cultures, and I think that the force of internal cohesion and external exclusion are just not as strong. I mean, sure it happens. I mean, you see pockets of the Irish all over America and the Italian. I mean, it for sure happens. This is not uniquely Jewish. What's uniquely Jewish is how strong the internal cohesion is. That's the portable homeland. I mean, we're going to trace this process. It's amazing. Like I said, you take the Gemara, you add some water, and poof, you've got the Jews, and it holds them together. Furthermore, they are insane. Have you ever seen what a Jew in the Middle Ages looks like? I mean, aside from the fact that they made us wear funny hats and like the badges and whatnot, which we'll speak about, right? They just don't look like everybody else. They don't talk like everybody else. They don't eat the same things as anybody else. They don't even actually want to sit in our buildings. You understand where I'm going with this? Is that there's a huge element of we like to call it, you know, Judeophobia, but it's Goyophobia. The Jews don't have anything to do with the Goyim. And that's a very powerful divider. So this issue, right? I want to explain a little bit more, and then I want to leave you guys with a thought about where history may or may not be going. So the internal cohesion, the positive core of Jewish identity at this point in our story, we've mapped out what it's built on. First of all, it's this communal structure of the Kehillah, right? Am Yisrael is not thinking nationally by and large anymore. There is a communal. There's the halachic side. If you're going to live as a Jew, you need halachic services. You need the guy who can check your meat. You need the person who can do circumcision. You need ritual baths. You need a synagogue, right? This is, by the way, in the modern state of Israel, we know this, that religious communities build themselves up through a service orientation. As soon as you can get a critical necessary, your school, your shul, etc., so people will move there. If you don't have that, it's the pioneers first, right? But there's also a very important element of what's coming in the Middle Ages, which is corporate identity, right? Not corporate in the sense of business, but corporate in the sense of collective. Right? It's the Middle Ages mark a retreat from the Greco-Roman model of citizenship, that every individual relates to the state, right? And an emergence or re-emergence of corporate identity, right? There is the king, and there are the Jews, and there are the Muslims, right? You have a unit, and therefore the ability of the individual to relate to society directly lies well ahead for the Jews in Europe. And that, of course, when will that happen? Emancipation. And that's why emancipation is so destructive to the religious structures that are built during the Middle Ages, because the religious structures that are built during the Middle Ages are based on the premise that the individual does not have a direct relationship to the social context. They are part of a corporate entity. Of course, that's a generalization. People are still people, right, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, that's the model. Emancipation returns to the Greco-Roman model of citizenship, and that poses huge challenges to Jewish life, right? The next piece, of course, in addition to the structure of the Kehillah, is this conversation of the Gemara. It's an internal conversation which allows not only, up until now, like the Gemara was a conversation between real people, even though, as we spoke about, it was crafted over hundreds of years. But once the text is closed, what happens is it no longer is just a conversation between people. It's actually a tool to shape those who can enter the conversation. You learn Gemara to become part of that conversation, and through the halakha, you shape the environment around you. It becomes a cultural matrix. The Gemara ceases to be just a conversation and becomes a tool for social construction, which is a very powerful tool at the disposal of the Jews to maintain internal cohesion, one which has actually never existed before, not on that scale, right? And so the last couple of minutes, I just want to pose a question for you, which is that there are two different ways to look at progress through time, right? And I call them the neoclassical and the cultural evolutionary. What do I mean? Neoclassical thinking boils down to the idea that things were better when. Right? That's like the Renaissance that looked back to Greco-Roman culture in Europe as the height of culture. Right? It's, by the way, a very present element of certain Jewish communities who look back to whether it was the rabbinic era or you know, Europe or whatever. Like, that's when things were the way they were supposed to be. And then everything that's happened in exile in the breakup has been a failure. So what's our goal? To get back to a situation which was ideal. That's neoclassical. You can find that type of thinking across the board. It's far from unique to the Jews, right? But you see what it does. It means that that history is essentially a string of accidents and failures which need to be overcome, right? And that the goal is to get back to the true Jew. You may have heard this type of discourse before. As opposed to the evolutionary model, which is that as you go along, every situation in which you find yourself brings to the fore an aspect of selfhood which otherwise would have remained unexpressed. When we find ourselves in Spain and Jewish poetry bursts to the fore because it's a core of Arab culture, poetry, is that because we've just become what are we culturally appropriating, right? And we're just trying to be like the Arabs? Or is it because there was a poetic soul that had not found an outlet until it experienced a culture which had the tools to give it voice? Now, that's a real question. And what I'll give to you as the parting thought in the last 2 minutes is that the evolutionary paradigm is intimidating to people because it means that we don't know who we are or where we're going. I mean, the neoclassical is attractive because I can create some illusion of what the Jews really are, located at some point in the past, where, by the way, it's safe because nobody really knows what it was like, so I can just tell you what it was like, right? It's very safe. My ideal is in the past. And then I can just beat my breast and mourn and use it as a stick for social exclusion and conformity to try to get us back to this ideal. You understand? It works logically in communal work. The evolutionary paradigm is open-ended. Where, what are we trying to get to, right? This whole argument, what are Jewish values? What's it mean to be a Jew? It's like, well, I don't know, right? So how do you overcome that? Is that the key to the evolutionary paradigm is the power of an unbroken conversation to maintain identity. So if you're still in discourse with the past, with all the voices of the past, then what happens is that life's disruptions, the encounters, and even conscious decisions to adopt ideas and practices from outside become part of a construction of a continuous identity. Right? So it necessitates almost moving backwards into the future. Oh, wait, thank you. Right? Meaning, at the very least, we're constantly, as we move forward, in dialogue with the past, asking questions of ourselves, of our ancestors, of our holy texts, etc., in order to make sure that wherever we go, we don't become someone other than who we are. And at this point in our history, right, the circumstance is going to lend us a very powerful tool for that, which is centralized leadership. What lies ahead is the birth of the Gaonim, right, of the last centralized leadership that Am Yisrael knows, and next week we'll speak about why that's so critical for our success, not only in their present day, but for moving into the future as well. But that lies ahead. See you next week.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.